Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban.
Got a second? I'm the Hoban Law Group's Steve Shane, and the Shane Second podcast cut throughs and captures the cannabis industry's key issues. And here we're going to briskly learn from industry icons what decisions to make, what line mines to stand step, and how to survive the perilous and profitable world of legalized marijuana and hemp. It only takes a second. And the most exciting second starts with psychedelics. If you were lucky enough to be in the ground floor of cannabis, if you were the architect of an entire industry, if you watched a nation turn at everything you did, then you might understand the next wave, psychedelics, the jobs it's going to provide, the health it's going to provide, and the importance it's going to provide to our economy. With us today is Noah Potter, considered probably across the globe as the world's leading person, I guess, on psychedelics policy and decriminalization. But to understand Noah Potter, you have to understand what is now called the Javits beheading. 3 years ago at the Jacob Javits Center, Roger Stone showed up, tanned, polished, confident, perhaps overconfident, unaware he'd stare down the one and only Noah Potter, former chair of the New York City Bar Association's Committee on Drug Law, the person who started the most influential psychedelic blog post, the New Amsterdam Psychedelic Law, a commercial litigator for over 20 years, in appellate, corporate control, and commercial real estate disputes. Noah took apart Roger Stone like a cheap suit. What befell him next? Infamy, prosecution, and perhaps incarceration. So welcome, Noah. It is a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
And for full disclosure, Noah and I are law partners at the Hoban Law Group, and we're 54 attorneys scattered across 17 offices across the globe. Noah has offices in New York City and is just a pivotal figure there in the history of cannabis and psychedelic law. In fact, is the general manager of the famous New York City Cannabis Day Parade. But Noah, I want to start at the absolute beginning of psychedelics. So much talk, so much enthusiasm. Can you tell me a little bit about the different forms psychedelics can take? I understand they can be either plant-based or synthetic.
Yes, Steve, that's a fair characterization. And people in discussing psychedelics, we'll talk about the history dating back to prehistoric use and the research showing that psychedelic substances have been used throughout history in all parts of the world, with just a few exceptions. There's a turn, new development, I guess, if you will, in the last century, with the synthesis of LSD, that opened up a new track, if you will. Our ancestors were using natural substances, what I like to call psychedelic biologicals, covering both plant-based and fungal-based, and in a rare instance, an animal-based psychedelic substance. So you're correct in that distinction.
So if I understand correctly, and I defer to you because you certainly are one of the experts, if not the expert, but on plant-based side, it seems like we're talking about mushroom-derived psilocybin. And then from the cactus plant, I understand there's peyote. And if I'm also correct on the synthetic side, I think you mentioned LSD, but wouldn't MDMA or Molly also be a synthetic psychedelic?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a whole host of substances that would fall on that side of the divide. I mean, just using LSD as a representative of the category. And just a point in terms of the biologically derived substances, I mean, you know, mushrooms are their own kingdom, the fungal kingdom. So people talk about plant-derived substances, it's perhaps a little bit broader than that.
When they talk about psychedelics, there's a great amount of romanticism, but I'd say a fair bit of misinformation about what it's used to treat. So I understand that it can go for both recognized disorders and also for a wellness application. So in terms of treating people who are presently unwell, in your practice, where have you seen hallucinogens applied?
There's a wide range, and people talk about use for depression, for anxiety, for anti-addictive properties, really across the board. And I hesitate to narrow the scope, and that's actually one of the reasons why psychedelics are disruptive, or as I like to call them, hybrid, because they don't match the standard paradigm of one substance, one condition. They are perhaps a tonic effect, in which you can have an entourage effect, and you might have one substance that's addressing multiple issues. Psilocybin, for example, has been proposed for a number of different conditions.
Okay, and on the wellness side, and this is particularly exciting to me, when they talk about it's used for people who perhaps are somewhere on the spectrum, is it true that it's been used for wellness applications for enhancing emotional empathy, increasing feelings of closeness, and promoting thoughtfulness, even contemplativeness? Is that true, Noah?
Well, yeah, I'm not going to say that that's coming out of a clinical context, but that's what the advocates for policy change who are coming from the grassroots are articulating in terms of wellness. And that has seeped into the commercial sector. But the idea of a wellness application, as again, that's why these are hybrid substances or disruptive, because they have a wellness application. In addition to making a person who's unwell well, the idea that you can make a person who's well feel even better is unusual, but is a hallmark of the psychedelic paradigm.
Part of the paradigm is kind of a confusion here, which I don't understand. Now, I understand that federally, the DEA lists psychedelics next to heroin on Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substance Act, but is it true what I'm hearing, that there's approximately 1,000 licenses that have been issued to physicians, researchers, and drug companies for controlled medical and scientific research of psychedelics?
Well, you got me on the exact number, Steve. I'm not going to pretend to know the number. But there has been, in fact, an explosion in research. My understanding, going back to about 1990s, when the floodgates began to lift. And to allow psychedelic research to go forward, there had been a block on psychedelic research going back to the late 70s, an unspoken rule that one would not allow this research to happen. And it's been, it's just been an avalanche, a tidal wave, whatever you want to call it, with research going on around the United States and around the world, really unprecedented. And a major departure from the prohibition of past decades.
It sounds like we're on the path to unleashing the giant within and finding out exactly what these substances can do. And it sounds like it's a journey. But I think the first step with psychedelics, I guess mirroring somewhat cannabis, is removing criminality. And I know you don't like to draw attention to yourself, but I know you were pivotal in the great developments we had in Denver. So can you talk a little bit about your experience in the city of Denver and helping removing the criminality that's been assigned to psychedelics?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm New York based. I'm licensed to practice in New York. And I don't pretend to, I would never try to practice Colorado law. My role was really in 2018. Kevin Matthews, who's the director of the Decriminalize Denver campaign, reached out to me in 2018 after hearing a podcast in which I talked about psychedelic law. And that's a term that I coined, psychedelic law, to describe an area that is up and coming. He reached out to me because he heard me talk about the concepts in psychedelic law and psychedelic policy that have yet to be developed fully. And over the next 4 months, I worked closely with Kevin in trying to devise the language that the Board of Elections would accept, and which they eventually did in September after, I think, two unsuccessful attempts previously. And I was speaking closely with Kevin, talking about strategy, talking about messaging, anticipating objections, thinking in terms of alliances to be forged, and so on. That was my role. I think back at the beginning of the process, and Kevin and I have been in touch subsequently. over the months and years to talk about development.
As we kind of wind this down, it sounds like there's a heck of a lot you have. I know you've written articles in addition to your new Amsterdam blog post. I know you've written a number of articles, which I think are going to be available on the Hoban Law Group website, which is hoban.law. But I think also we need to point out that some of the trailblazing work that you did in Denver has also kind of been mirrored in other cities like Oakland, Santa Cruz, some success in Portland, Chicago, and Berkeley. So to be on the ground floor and trying to get richer, which is a big part of what we do at our law firm, help people out in that regard, is really starting out on the right foot, organizing your area, helping get the right laws passed, and helping put this brand new economy in place with psychedelics. There's so much more we could talk about, Noah. We could talk about esketamine in terms of the FDA's approval of it, or the breakthrough status that's been conferred on MDMA and psilocybin to fast track for PTSD and depression treatment. But unfortunately, we only have so much time. But what do you see next, Noah? What do you think the puck is going to be next in the burgeoning psychedelic development?
Well, we got to stay tuned to what's happening at the state and local level. I would say that the action is in Oregon right now. California is not moving forward, but it's important to look at Oregon. There are developments in other jurisdictions. Something with which I'm familiar and active, which I'm not at liberty to discuss at the moment. But that's where you know that we're going to see action is a local level. People not waiting for the FDA, waiting for drug developers to go through that process, but taking action immediately because these are known substances. There are at least decades, in some cases centuries, of human use. And it's a little bit of following the gameplay of cannabis. People know, they trust their own experiences. They trust they've experienced. They trust what they've seen in others. And they're not going to wait. They're going to go for it because there's a clear and pressing need, horrific rates of mental illness, of just mental unwellness. Substance abuse and so on, and when people want relief, they want relief, and they're not going to let a bureaucracy get in the way. And so, part of it's going to be the popular movement that's going to, I think, force the attention of policymakers, and we've seen that to some extent already. And then we're going to look at the feedback relationship between the grassroots activists and the elected officials, particularly the legislators, who may be induced to intervene to liberalize access. And there'll be a feedback relationship.
I think what you're saying here, too, that before you can get to the good thing of making the profit and have favorable benefit of the tax laws, before we can issue security, before we can apply for licensure, before we can do and defend all kind of intellectual property or perhaps have to go through litigation, the core of it, I think, Noah Pata, is you and the policy work. So thank you for everything you've done in cannabis. Thank you for everything you're doing in psychedelics. And remember, our biggest enemy is ignorance. How do we defeat ignorance 1 second at a time? This has been the Shane Second. Please join us on our next podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.